This is an ABC podcast. This is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Good afternoon, it certainly is, and it's Peter Somerville here with you this afternoon. Our week on the road continues, and I'm bringing you the show live today from the Australian Dairy Conference. We're here at Albert Park. We're in the bright lights of Melbourne, and the show today is all about culture. The question is, would you work in the dairy industry? And does the industry have a good culture? But if dairy's not your thing, there's plenty more coming up as well, so stay tuned. And as always, please get in touch. If you'd like to have your say, get in touch on 0467 842 722. That's 0467 842 722. Looking forward to hearing from you. We are, of course, here at the Australian Dairy Conference, but before I get into all that, I want to take a few minutes for another conversation. The chairman and CEO of Saputo is in the country, touring facilities and speaking with staff. And despite the company investing in plant-based drinks, Lino Saputo Jr. says dairy isn't dead and that the company will never forgo milk processing for other non-dairy beverages. He says there are no plant closures planned and shared his rosy outlook for the industry. Let's hear from him.
Well, the Australian platform is performing as good as we could expect, given the circumstances and the decline in the milk production here. The programs that we had to invest funds in our facilities are still ongoing. The efficiencies that we're extracting through the synergies of Warrnambool Bull Cheese and Butter, Murray Goulburn, and the assets we acquired from Lion Dairy and Drinks are really performing extremely well. I cannot be more delighted.
But at the same time, milk production and global prices have fallen. How can there be such a rosy picture here in Australia?
Well, I think that there were some synergies that we needed to extract from the platforms that we acquired. Those plans are still moving ahead. We're becoming more efficient. We're becoming more effective. We're producing higher quality products. And we're channeling the milk that we have into higher margin products. And so it's a question of taking the right decision at the right time, despite the very, very difficult circumstances. So we're not running our plants at the full capacity utilization that we would like to, but we are taking some very good strategic decisions. So no issues with this platform at all.
You said that the plants aren't running at full capacity. Are we going to see any more plant closures?
No, you won't see any more plant closures. Our plants are probably 300 to 400 million liters of milk away from getting it to the capacity utilization that I would like to have. That's going to come through a more patron-based milk, some co-pack products, and some third-party milk. So we're not announcing any plant closures. What we have done to be proactive is that we've announced in December the seasonal closure of the Mafra facility. So the plant will be shut down for 5 months. What we have done is that we've either relocated or redeployed some of our talent that's there, the employees. We've provided them opportunities to learn new functions and to work in other locations. And I'm going to tell you that I'm delighted to see that our employees are so supportive of our initiatives. So really no complaints at all. No plans for any plant closures. We're still very optimistic that we're going to get to our 90% capacity utilization rate.
You're also investing in plant-based drinks. Where do they fit into this picture?
Well, look, we have the assets to process any type of fluid products. And so when I made the announcement of us venturing into plant-based products, it was really as a complement to the infrastructure that we have. It's not replacing dairy. So let me be extremely clear about this. We are still a dairy-focused company. We believe that dairy is not dead. Dairy is not dead in the world markets. Dairy is not dead in Australia. So we are focused on dairy first and foremost. But we do have expertise. We do have the talent. We do have the infrastructure to process product other than dairy. So why not leverage all of that goodwill that we have into producing products for perhaps people who have brands but don't have the infrastructure?
These drinks, though, aren't milk-based. Where does it leave Australian dairy farmers?
Well, look, as long as there's milk being produced in Australia, we will process that milk. There is no way that we will forego milk processing for any other kind of processing. Our main priority is the dairy industry. As long as there is going to be milk that is going to be offered to us, we will have the capacity to process it. So it doesn't set aside the priorities that we have for dairy at all.
People would look at this and think it's maybe a bit of a diversification move. At the same time, how can you allow retailers to command $1.10 a litre for milk? What expense does that come out to your business?
Well, look, for us, I've said this very, very clearly from the very first day that we were in Australia. I never believed in dollar a litre of milk. We've been pushing very, very hard for the retailers to get that price up. Now they're at $1.10. I think that there is more room to go. In fact, over the course of the last quarter, we have announced milk price increases to the market, and that will affect our fluid milk products. That will affect our cheese products, and we have been able, because we took price increases, to take a step up in our milk price that goes to dairy farmers. So I think we're acting very responsibly in the dairy space. I'm just hoping that that things get better for the dairy farmers. It's been a very difficult time for them. We need to offer them our support.
You say you're acting responsibly in the dairy space. Do you think the same can be said of the retailers? Are they good corporate citizens?
Well, look, I'm not going to speak publicly about the retailers. I think they have their own programs and their own ideas. What I'm more concerned about are the initiatives that Saputo is taking. So, the farmer dairy costs are very high. When you think about the fodder and the feed, you think about the issues they have with water and the drought and the fires. We know that they're going through some very, very difficult times. So irrespective of what the retailers are doing, we want to come up with our own programs that are going to be substantial to create some goodwill and some momentum in the industry where the dairy farmers can feel very, very good about the future here. And when I talk about substantial amounts of money that we want to give to these programs, I'm talking in the millions of dollars that we believe as leaders of the dairy industry, we need to be there to support our dairy farmers. So we're looking for the right programs. We need to make sure that the funds are going to create good infrastructure for the sustainability of the dairy space. So I'm still very optimistic and I'm still very bullish about the dairy industry, and we're putting our money where our mouth is.
If we can just talk quickly about the Australian Dairy Plan, do you agree with the recommendations of that document?
I'm not familiar with that document specifically, but what I can tell you is I believe in the infrastructure that we have in Australia. I believe in the talent that we have here in Australia, and I believe that we will continue to progress in this industry, irrespective of whatever regulations come out, whether they would be the dairy code or anything else. We believe that we could be contributors to this industry.
Sorry, you support it, but you don't know what the recommendation was?
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is I'm supporting progress within the dairy industry. When you had the code of conduct that came out, the 11 pillars of the conduct, we supported that. In fact, we also talked about making step downs illegal. So we want to see progress in the dairy industry. And if there is logic and common sense to programs, then we will support them. That's what I'm saying.
So there you have it. Dairy is not dead. Lino Saputo Jr. there. 13 minutes past 12 on the Country Hour, just about to go 14 minutes past. In fact, it's Peter Somerville here with you today. And if you do want to get in touch, you can do so on 0467 842 722. We're here at the Australian Dairy Conference today, where the conversation revolves around culture. And the question is, does the Australian dairy industry have a healthy culture? To discuss that, we're joined by Dairy Australia Chair Jeff Odgers. Jeff, good afternoon.
Morning. Afternoon, absolutely.
It's only just gone.
Forgive
me that one. There's a lot of people here today and a lot of conversations going on. What have you picked up at the conference so far?
Look, there's a really positive vibe around the conference, and I think there's an appetite for this conversation about industry culture, given some of the challenges of recent years, and yet at this time some really strong milk prices in many parts of the Australian industry. And what we need to keep looking to the future in this industry, that's critical, and that's what this conference always endeavours to do.
And you, of course, presented earlier this morning, and the question of that presentation was whether the industry needs a culture check. What does that mean, and do we need one?
I think the industry does need a culture check to a degree. It's the industry, at its core, has a good culture. But we've come through such a challenging period over quite, you know, deep. I mean, the bushfires recently, but people remember back to price step downs. So many events that, in a cumulative sense, just have industry not feeling as positive as they used to. So I think we do need to raise our sights and contemplate how we come closer together as industry, because the pressures of the recent past, particularly, you know, we're such a big country and quite diverse in the way that dairy operates around that country, and that's tend to push us a bit apart and fragment us. And I think there's a real opportunity to come back together and understand each other better and work on our issues, create the opportunities.
Because so much has happened in such a short space of time, hasn't it? Do we need to kind of take a moment and just step back and reassess where the industry's at, maybe? Is that what we all need to do?
I think we do. And I think the industry organisations actually recognised this some time ago, and that's why we embarked on the Australian Dairy Plan exercise. And it was fantastic that so many people attended those regional workshops in all parts of the country, and there was a really strong message in there about let's try and create a more positive industry. And so we tried to bring all that together. There's a lot of common themes in what people are looking for. And I mean, new entrants and investment into the industry is really important to people. Marketing and promoting what we do, recognising the value of dairy in all sorts of ways, products of course, but the value of dairy communities in this country. There's so much that lives there. I think we're challenged with profit and risk in an era when I think we all recognise that climate change is having an impact.
And if we can just come back to the dairy plan, you mentioned the consultation there. Do you think that the final recommendation that we're now all discussing and working through, does that hit the mark? Is that reflective of all of that consultation?
So there was a call from those workshops for much more unity in industry, and people wanted a voice, and they wanted one voice to a large extent. So I think that, and you're talking about the JTT's recommendations there around how we reform industry structures. There's a lot more that sits in Australian Dairy Plan as well as that. But that's our first commitment. I mean, that's critical. And industry organisations have committed to work with industry and reform industry structures and create a more influential and united advocacy voice. That's right.
I think the contention, though, is around having the processes involved in determining where R&D money is spent. Is that appropriate?
Processor involvement is really about the pre-competitive work. I think there are a lot of people in industry that take a view that whole of chain is the best way to approach this, because we can't resolve our differences standing a long way apart. I think we need to understand that processor involvement is fundamentally anchored, though, in the pre-competitive work around sustainability, around marketing, and even how we go to farmers with programs that can make a difference on farm. And beyond that, I mean, I would fully expect if this model is created, and I hope that it is, that individual processors, because they are commercial entities and they do compete, and they would step away from that structure after doing that pre-competitive work, and they would continue to be competitive in the marketplace as we need them to be.
And if I can just take you back to that conversation with Lino Saputo Jr. Speaking as a dairy farmer, how do you feel about his moves towards processing plant-based beverages? Is that a good thing?
I think Lino is looking at global trends, and he's recognising that we we need to reconsider that landscape. And what he's trying to tap into is keeping dairy on the front page, but he's just partnering in a small way with some of these other foods that people are interested in trying.
Is it good to have a bet each way?
Well, Lino thinks it is.
and what Lino thinks is good for you.
Look, I think Saputo's investment in the Australian industry very important. You know, Lino's a global operator. He's always positive about this industry, and I think this industry should welcome that.
All right. Well, Jeff Odgers, thank you very much for joining us on the Country Hour.
Thanks, Peter.
Jeff Odgers there is the chair of Dairy Australia. We'll be right back with you in just a second on the Country Hour. And yes, pop those headphones on because I was going to play something and I haven't got it here, so we'll roll. We'll keep rolling forward. My next guest is John Roche, who's made the trip across from New Zealand for this event. John's taking to the stage later on to discuss the five biggest challenges facing the dairy industry. John, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Peter.
Thanks for joining us. Can you quickly tell us about your involvement in the dairy industry in New Zealand?
Oh, so my involvement is long and varied. So I bought my first farm when I was 19 in Ireland. As you can tell from my accent, I'm not a Kiwi. And moved from Ireland to Australia, actually, to Victoria in 1995. Spent 5 years working as a dairy scientist down in Ellenbank in West Gippsland. And then went to New Zealand in 2000. And so my involvement has been either as a senior scientist or a principal scientist working across farm systems and dairy cow nutrition, or I've been involved in developing dairy farms in Canterbury through the early part of the 2000s, and then in North America through the latter part of that first decade of the 2000s.
I'm very pleased to hear a Gippsland connection there. That's good. That's good news for me.
Absolutely. Well, my wife is from Gippsland, so she it's good news for her too.
Even better. It's getting better by the second. Tell me, you're talking about the five big challenges facing dairy farmers. What are they?
So in my opinion, I'm sure, look, if you ask anybody that question, you'll get five different answers. So in my opinion, I think climate change is a huge challenge to anyone working with the natural biological systems. Biosecurity, I think, going forward is a huge challenge, probably that people haven't really thought about in the past. And that's because we've got increasing tourist numbers, we've got increasing cargo ship containers coming in to both Australia and to New Zealand. And we're not seeing an equal increase in resourcing of those services. With the climate changing, the countries are becoming more hospitable to different pests and weeds, etc. And so the challenge is increasing from all different sides. So biosecurity is probably a reasonably big one. I threw government regulations in there for farmers because what I wanted to talk about, actually, I should go back a second. What I wanted to talk about was challenges that farmers could do something about, that were still within their sphere of influence. And government regulations, even though they may think they're not within their sphere of regulations, they are. I mean, governments are regulators of last resort. They don't like to regulate. They regulate when they have to regulate. And so when we step in to regulate, you know, on a health and safety basis, it's because we see too many people getting hurt, laid off, serious injuries, or fatalities in different businesses, and farming is no exception to that, obviously. Same from human resources perspective, people working long hours in poor conditions, we have to regulate those. The dairy industry, obviously, animal welfare, environmental regulations, all of those things are front and center. But the dairy industry has the opportunity as a collective voice. You know, you were talking to Jeff from Dairy Australia there just before me. A huge opportunity as a collective voice to connect with government and have a say in what those regulations should be. And more importantly, police their own industry from within so that the regulations don't come over the top of them. Fourth one I talked about was how we equip ourselves to make our own decisions. You know, it's really, really important as our businesses have got bigger, the skills needed to run them has become greater, and they're not all biophysical skills. You know, the skills that we really embraced as young people, the reasons why we went into farming, and so we need better business skills. And one of the things I was talking about there was the cost of marginal milk. So marginal milk is the additional milk we produce when we make a change to our system, whether that's we buy new equipment or we buy more cows or we buy more feed or whatever. And analyzing the farm business beyond just the average cost, just beyond the profit, to understand whether that marginal milk is actually profitable or whether we're actually paying for the privilege of producing milk. And then the fifth one that I talked about was public sentiment, and really trying to give people the understanding that people buy a process, they don't buy a product. And Australia and New Zealand have a fabulous process of producing food. We produce healthy, the most nutritious food on the planet. We produce it in an incredibly safe environment. We've got very, very strong food safety regulations, so we're really well trusted. We've got a good environmental footprint and constantly looking to improve that, self-improvement and through regulations. And so we've got a process to tell. We've got free-range animals where other people have housed animals. We produce, a low-carbon footprint milk compared with many other countries. So it's really, they're the five challenges. I think they're challenges, but they're challenges that bring opportunities.
And they sound... to introduce some jargon, we talk about SMART goals, which are achieve. help me out. They're achievable. They're realistic.
They're specific, measurable. Yeah,
they're sound achievable.
Repeatable. Absolutely. I mean, climate change is happening, and as individuals, we have a limited ability to change that. I mean, collectively as individuals, obviously, we have an enormous opportunity. But the worst thing a farmer could do is bury their head in the sand and say this isn't happening. There's a lot of research going on in Australia into better genetics for heat stress, into feeds that have a cooling effect rather than a heating effect. Some excellent work done here in Melbourne University and with the department, in Frank Dunshay's group and Christy Di Giacomo. So there's a lot of work going on. It's about embracing that, upskilling, and planning. You know, as governors of our business, we need to plan, we need to be responsible and not just ignore the signs.
Mm. You're listening to the Victorian Country Hour. It's 27 minutes past 12. Peter Somerville here with you today. My guest is John Roche, who's made the trip across from New Zealand, but also has quite a strong, worked here in Australia as well. So I'm interested, you mentioned government relations before. Do we do that effectively here in Australia? And how do our approaches in Australia and New Zealand compare?
I'm not as familiar, obviously, with how the government works in Australia as I am in New Zealand. The very obvious difference is we have a single government, you have a federal and state governments, and obviously they will have their agreements and their disagreements. So that's a complication that thankfully we don't have. But we do have our regional governments and our central government that we have to interact with. I think we've got a very, very similar approach, similar foundation in terms of colonies and a similar rule of law and very similar values. So in terms of inclusion and genuinely wanting to work with citizens to provide the best outcome for all citizens. And again, to be fair, I think that's what the vast majority of citizens want as well.
And we talked also about public sentiment there before. Is that where the culture component and the discussion today comes into play? Is that the manageable component of all this?
I think that's a part of it. I mean, one of the earlier speakers this morning talked about, we decide every day when we get up how we feel. That's not decided for us. People can influence us, but we decide on how we're going to react to that. That is within our control. And so I think culture is incredibly important, and the work ethic that goes with farming is a huge part of that culture. But like any industry or any group of people that feel attacked, then the immediate response by anyone is to attack back. It's the best form of defense. And I think what people need to understand is that's not an effective form of attack. The dairy industry or the agricultural industries in general, and it's not just the dairy industry, fisher people feel under attack, a lot of the horticulturalists feel under attack, etc. The way to address that is by embracing, is by engaging with the consumers. There's a small proportion of people that will never agree with you. They just disagree with your very existence. But there's an enormous group of people, and the surveys here in Australia show that are really respectful of farming, of the healthy and nutritious and safe food that farmers here in Australia and in New Zealand present to them, and the affordability of that. So I think it's more about engaging with them genuinely on their concerns, recognizing that their concerns are real. Even if you don't agree with them, they're actually real because it's what they feel and believe. And it is really about engaging with them on their feelings.
And you mentioned we do need to get to the news, but I'm really interested by this. Tell me, you mentioned there we're in control of how we feel when we wake up, whether it's here in Australia or internationally. What does the industry need to do to feel better when we wake up?
Oh, I think recognize what we are doing. You know, when we look at all of the problems of the world, we can make choices that limit our footprint. So, for example, we can take public transport rather than driving to work, or we can, if we're a short distance from work or from school, we can cycle rather than hopping in a car. Food is the one thing we cannot check out of. And as one of the earlier speakers was showing this morning, the foods we produce, the dairy is the highest quality protein and the most nourishing nutrient available to consumers. So we get up in the morning to nourish the world. It's a fantastic vision. And if you get out of bed thinking that, don't worry about what the naysayers say. Certainly listen to them. Maybe some of their concerns have validity, or maybe we just need to understand where they're coming from and engage with them on that. But don't lose sight of our goal here, which is to leave the world in a better place than it was when we arrived.
Some very good perspective there. I love it. John Roche, thank you so much for joining us on the Country Hour.
Pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
John Roche, who's made the trip across from New Zealand and joins us on the Country Hour today. It's Peter Somerville with you, but of course, we do have to get to the news. And for that, we're joined by Leonie Thorne. Good afternoon, Leonie.
Good afternoon, Peter. The mayor of the Strathbogie Shire in northeast Victoria says residents in three towns are completely shaken up by a plane crash that claimed the lives of four people yesterday. The Australian Transport Safety Bureau is investigating after the mid-air crash between two planes. Mayor Amanda McLaren says her sympathies go out to the families involved. A Ballarat headmaster will take over Melbourne Catholic College St Kevin's, which is in damage control after a grooming scandal exposed by the ABC's Four Corners program. St Patrick's College headmaster John Crowley has been appointed to the role of principal at St Kevin's after its headmaster Stephen Russell resigned. St Patrick's vice principal Stephen Hill will take over running the Ballarat school. The state's conservation regulator has executed four search warrants in the southwest as an investigation into the killing of dozens of koalas at Cape Bridgewater continues. The Environment Department has completed its search of the Cape Bridgewater property. A total of 184 koalas have been processed, and the majority have been released to wilderness areas. The plantation is no longer being treated as a crime scene. The state government says it's secured the future of the iconic stall gift until at least 2023. Australia's oldest professional foot race has received a government funding package of just over $1.2 million. Under the deal, the Northern Grampians Shire Council will also contribute $150,000 and in-kind support for the race venue at Central Park. The Albury Tigers Football Club has been fined by the Ovens and Murray Football League over an incident in the fire-affected Upper Murray region. The team had been staying at a caravan park to help with the fire recovery earlier this month, but were asked to leave due to antisocial behaviour. In a statement, the league said the club has been fined an undisclosed amount for breaching the bylaws. And a popular lake in the Latrobe Valley is reopening to the public after it was closed earlier this week. The Latrobe City Council closed Lake Narrakan in Newborough after blue-green algae was found in the water. The council says the water is now safe, but it will continue to monitor its quality. That's all in headlines. For more, you can search for ABC News online or on social media, or tune in again at 1 o'clock.
Thanks very much, Leonie. Bringing you back now to the Australian Dairy Conference here at Albert Park. I did slip up earlier and said Port Albert, and had a few people laughing there, but we are at Albert Park, and it's time now to get the latest weather details. And for that, good afternoon to Michael Efron at the Bureau of Meteorology.
Good afternoon, Peter.
Tell us what's going on outside.
Well, it's quite cloudy across much of southern and mountain Victoria, with a high-pressure system well to the west, and that's directing those cool and moist south-to-southwesterly winds and bringing some light shower activity to those southern districts. But most of that has actually cleared, and so it is generally cloudy, although dry, in the south. But for northern Victoria, we are looking at mostly sunny skies at the moment with those cool southerly winds. Temperatures there getting into the low 20s at the moment, but in the south with that cloud cover, generally around the mid-teens at the moment. But as we head into the rest of the afternoon, we're going to see temperatures in those northern districts reaching the mid to high 20s, 29 at Wodonga today, 27 up at Wangaratta, as well as Swan Hill, 25 at Shepparton, 26 at Echuca. But in the south, with that cloud cover, only getting to 18 at Warrnambool and Ballarat, 19 at Hamilton, 21 at Sale and Bairnsdale. So temperatures around 4 to 5 degrees below average for this time of year. As we head into Friday, we're going to see a weak cold front crossing Bass Strait, so that will maintain the shower activity in the south during the morning. However, as we head into Friday afternoon, those showers will become confined to the Gippsland Ranges. We'll see another sunny day across the north of the state, and in the south we could even see some breaks in the cloud during Friday afternoon. And in terms of temperatures, not that different from today, so looking at the high teens to low 20s in the south, and across the north of Victoria generally around the mid to high 20s, 28 at Mildura and Swan Hill, 26 at Shepparton, 29 for Wangaratta, 30 at Albury Wodonga. And for those northern areas, a fairly cool start to the day on Friday as well, temperatures between around 9 and 11 degrees. Quite a settled weekend coming up on Saturday. We'll see generally sunny skies across the north of the state with temperatures into the high 20s or low 30s, 31 at Shepparton, 32 at Wodonga. But in the south, still looking at some cloud cover during the morning. It should be a mostly sunny afternoon. We'll still have those onshore winds, so that will keep temperatures down a touch in the south, 21 for Ballarat, 22 at Sale, 23 at Bairnsdale. But into Sunday, we do see that high moving over the Tasman Sea, bringing warmer northeasterly winds over Victoria. So getting into the mid-30s across the north, high 20s to low 30s in the south of Victoria, and a generally sunny day, so a pretty good day on Sunday. Heading into Monday, we do see a low pressure trough over New South Wales extending into northern Victoria, so that could generate some shower and thunderstorm activity across eastern areas on Monday afternoon, especially near the ranges. Another warm day expected, mid-30s across the north, high 20s to low 30s in the south. And then on Tuesday, that shower and storm activity does become more extensive over eastern districts. Still looking at a warm day, especially through northern parts, 38 at Mildura on Tuesday, 35 at Shepparton, 35 also at Wangaratta, 28 at Hamilton, 27 at Bairnsdale. Overnight Tuesday into Wednesday, we do see a front crossing southern Victoria, and that does mean a much cooler day on Wednesday with showers affecting southern districts. Not a huge amount of rain in that, but certainly those temperatures a lot lower compared to previous days, back to the high teens to low 20s in the south and the mid to high 20s over northern Victoria. So not a lot of rain coming up over the next week. No really hot days either, but certainly some nice weather across the weekend.
Good to hear. Michael Efron there. Thanks very much for joining us on the Country Hour.
Thanks, Peter.
Coming good for the weekend by the sound of it. It's Peter Somerville here with you on the Country Hour this afternoon. It's 21 minutes to one. And we're going to move on from dairy now. We are coming to you from the Australian Dairy Conference today, but moving on. And bulk handler GrainCorp is set to receive an insurance payout of almost $58 million after another disastrous harvest in New South Wales and Queensland. The figure was detailed in the company's annual general meeting in Sydney today. Angus Furley reports.
Of $113 million in the financial year ending September 30. That was in large part because of a disastrous harvest in the eastern states in 2018. So to reduce the company's financial exposure in droughts, last June GrainCorp announced it had taken out an insurance package to receive $15 per tonne for grain production below a 15.3 million tonne threshold in Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria. The company's chairman, Graham Bradley, says the insurance package will be a substantial boost to cash flow this financial year.
Our crop production contract with White Rock Insurance, which is a subsidiary of the Aon Group, a large international insurance group, is a significant innovation and will strengthen the long-term sustainability of the company. As announced yesterday, based on the crop production estimates of the Australian Bureau of Agricultural Resource Economics, the winter crop production estimate for eastern Australia is 11.44 million metric tonnes, and as a result GrainCorp expects to receive under the crop production contract a gross payment of $57.9 million for here in this 2020 financial year.
Mr. Bradley says the insurance package was developed specifically for GrainCorp.
This is a unique arrangement. There isn't anything quite like it in the insurance world, so it was actually evolved when we went looking for a way to underpin the balance sheet of Grain Company, of GrainCorp, in the event of a recurrence of drought years or difficult years. I believe we've announced or we've disclosed the premium in the scheme booklet, and it's approximately $6 million a year. So for a relatively modest premium, we have the protection of a contract that can pay us in a very bad year up to $80 million, and in a good year we will, of course, make a payment to the insurer up to a total of $70 million. And there are some conditions around that. But from our point of view, that seemed a very affordable and modest premium to provide us with that better security against poor years.
Speaking at the GrainCorp AGM, Mr. Bradley also detailed the company's plan to demerge its grain handling business from its international malting business.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we all appreciate this is an exceptional AGM, as it will be the last meeting of shareholders before we seek shareholder approval to demerge our malt business to create a new listed company which we have named United Malt Group. The demerger proposal will be put before shareholders for their consideration at an extraordinary general meeting to be held at 10 o'clock on Monday the 16th of March in this very same venue. Most shareholders, I think, will be familiar with the events of the past 12 months at GrainCorp, which have involved a comprehensive review of our portfolio of businesses in order to assess a range of strategic options designed to create value for shareholders. This has culminated in the board's decision that it is in the best interest of shareholders to demerge the malt business, thereby creating two high-quality ASX-listed agribusiness companies. If the scheme is approved by shareholders, it will proceed to a second court hearing, which is what happens with a scheme of arrangement, on the 20th of March and will become effective on the 23rd of March. Upon the demerger, eligible shareholders, that is all GrainCorp shareholders at that date, will receive one share of United Malt for each share they hold in GrainCorp while retaining their share in GrainCorp. GrainCorp will also retain a minority 10% stake in the United Malt Company, which will provide the company, GrainCorp, with additional balance sheet resources and financial flexibility for the future.
That was GrainCorp Chairman Graham Bradley ending that report from Angus Furley. That AGM, of course, was yesterday, not today, in fact.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Peter Somerville here with you on the Victorian Country Hour today. It's 16 minutes to one. And we're jumping back to Evoke Ag yesterday. Now, we've heard so much this week from the conference, including a lot of high-level discussions looking to the future. But at the same time, there's a huge number of producers already implementing new technology on farm. It allows them to produce more food with less inputs. I caught up with Sue Middleton and Brad Jones from Western Australia, as well as Mark Mortimer from New South Wales. And Mark kicked the chat off with an explanation of what he's implementing on farm.
So what we're trying to do is take large amounts of data that we gather on our sheep, and we need to present it in a way that your average sheep producer can make a decision on it. So the really tough thing is you don't want to present somebody with a sheet of numbers, but you need to present them with that sheet of numbers information in a very digestible way, and that gives people a pleasurable experience when they come to buy rams from us, or an easy experience. And that's, in a nutshell where we're trying to get to. And there's obviously a lot of technology behind taking all those measurements and turning them into a decision-making piece of information.
Brad, and I understand that you've also incorporated data into a lot of the decision-making processes on your farm. Why have you done that, and how has it benefited you?
The main reason was just the risk involved with being a dryland broadacre cropper. The volatility of our seasons led to unprofitable situations if we didn't start managing our bottom line. And it was all about introduction of technology to assist in lowering that. So, we had basically de-risking our farm.
And so you've got quite a diversified farm business. Where does technology come into the mix for you?
Yeah, so for us, the big innovation was really looking at a completely different operation than just staying in broadacre cropping. So we were broadacre cropping and livestock. And when we looked at the climate change predictions about 20 years ago, we went, shit, that's really severe for southwest Western Australia. So we decided that we wanted to diversify and developed an irrigated operation, which is a citrus orchard. Anyway, so 15 years on, what we've now done is we've built a pack shed, which is we're basically doing the export program for the Western Australian citrus industry, and we've incorporated a high level of technology in that operation so that we can track every bit of fruit, and it enables us to grade every piece of fruit. And we're gearing up to getting to the stage where we can actually see the internal characteristics of the fruit as well, because then that really helps us to place every single piece of fruit into one of, anywhere 7 different countries, and or we can go, any number of different grades in the domestic market. So what we're then doing is basically finding a home for every piece of fruit, and that's a big issue in hort, because you get a lot of wastage, because there might be blemish or something wrong with, externally on a piece of fruit, but it's still internally a great piece of fruit. So we're doing that, and that's really enabling us to optimise price. So for us, it's all about managing risk, and then managing risk to do with markets, which is pricing.
And people might listen to that and think it's quite advanced, but have you achieved everything you want to with technology? Is there still room to grow and expand?
Yeah, we've got 3 projects on the go at the moment. We're planning a blockchain project. We're planning another project which is going to enable us to monitor every tree. Basically, it's using satellite technology, but it's actually going to be able to show us what the uptake in every block and then down to a tree level, so that we can look at what's happening with our irrigation, because it's physically one of the things about agriculture when it's large areas is you need to have granular data, but you need to do it at scale. And so that's what ag tech actually enables you to do. It doesn't replace a human. It actually just supports the human decision-making process. And then we've got a 3rd project around, as I said to you, about the internal characteristics of fruit. So for us, it's just all about, we want the next level of technology as fast as we can, but you've got to afford it in your business, because you've still got to sell a piece of fruit, and you've got to sell it into a market that doesn't understand that all of that is in the background. So it puts your cost of production up if you're doing all of that stuff too quickly, so you can only do it on a staged basis. So no, we would love to do more, and that's why we're such strong advocates for the government in supporting farmers to get into the innovation space, because then that helps drive growth, it drives jobs, it does all the good stuff that we want for our regions and our communities.
And Brad and Mark, Sue was just talking about the the way that, time and money sort of gets in the way of rolling these projects out. How much, to what extent has that been a factor for you? How has that changed the rollout of projects that you want to get onto your farm?
Certainly time's an issue for us. So, you know, if you're going to roll out a new project or a new tech, there's a learning phase. You've got to do your research and your background. And at the same time, you've got to keep your existing business running. So, yeah, it's, even though you can see the goals at the end of the tunnel and, you know, once I get through this pain point, I should get more time. And typically what happens is when I get that more time, I move to the next project and then you hit a new time pain point, if you like. But it's just a matter to keep rolling forward. That's the way I see it.
And Brad, what's next for you in your business?
So we're moving down the automation road. Like part of the reason behind our investment in tech has been able to optimise our labour and all of our inputs. But now, as labour is becoming scarcer and scarcer, we're looking at starting to automate things so that it's about having the framework to be able to let that, you know, work autonomously.
Oh, back with you, Peter Somerville. Brad Jones ending that report from Evoke Ag. We're Warwick Long and I are here too busy playing on Twitter to realise when our stories are finishing, so excuse us. The world's first mobile pellet harvester visited Western Victoria earlier this month, giving farmers a chance to see the machine outside of Europe for the first time. The Krone Premos 5000 picks up windrows of straw and hay, and rather than producing bales, produces pellets. Corbin Schuster, a farmer at Freeling in South Australia, travelled more than 700 kilometres to see it in action. He spoke to rural reporter Angus Verley.
We've heard about this machine and we've heard that it's been in development for the last 4 or 5 years, and I guess I spent the last 4 or 5 years looking at pictures on the internet and watching YouTube videos, and I just wanted to see this thing operate in the flesh and see what all the fuss is about. So we hopped in the car and... 700 k's down and 700 k's back, a bit over, and we got to see this new type of machine operating out in the field, which is fantastic.
So you got a close-up look at it, you got to see it in action. Well, what were your thoughts?
Oh, look, I think it's an entirely new concept of packaging fodder and hay and straw. I guess we've come from sheaves of hay to round bales, to small squares to round bales, and then I guess 30 or 40 years ago, they went to big square balers, and now this is, I guess, a different way of packaging fodder, which, we can store. It gives the option of storing a lot more fodder, hay or straw in a given area. So it was really interesting to head down and just see this. Normally, you see pellet mills stuck in a shed somewhere, but this one was out in the paddock powered by a tractor. So it was very interesting to go and have a look at it, actually.
And what do you think the theory would be in terms of handling those pellets once the machine produces them? Where to from there?
Well, I guess that question was asked, and they were saying that you can handle them with your standard grain bucket, or they can be augured out of silos as well. But I guess the one takeaway that I had from it, they had a bulk bag sitting there with a bit over a ton of pellets in it, and that was the same amount of straw as two 4x3 big square bales. And the biggest takeaway was the fact that these big square bales, even the high-density ones now, are capable of no more than 230 kilos per cubic metre of product, whereas these pellets, you're storing upwards of 700 kilos of product per cubic metre. So, for storage, I guess, and for freight of product, whether it's across a country like Australia up to drought areas or whether it's export, it's a lot better for to have a denser product that's able to be transported and have a lower transport cost associated with it.
In terms of its capacity, I did see a few people, I suppose, raising eyebrows about its capacity, maybe not as much as they thought it might be. Was it around 5 tonnes an hour that they thought they could get out of it?
I think that's what they were talking about. So in optimal conditions, it's 5 tonnes an hour, and then suboptimal, it's 3 to 4 tonnes an hour. But I mean, I guess it's the start of the process. This is a new concept, and it's I guess if you look at a modern jet airliner now compared to the Wright brothers' plane, it's quite a difference. Or even a Holden Ute, like a VF Holden Ute versus an FJ or FX. We're at the start of the process, and these things will develop over time. And I dare say they'll develop new ways. Or this is, like I said, start of the process. They'll develop new ways of increasing productivity with it.
Now, sort of still in its demonstration phase, but did you get a clear figure of the price tag?
The price tag they were talking was $550,000 to $600,000 ballpark figure.
So pretty serious money.
It is quite serious money, but everything seems to be going up and up and up. I'm just parked in front of a petrol station at the moment. Everything seems to be going up and up.
Was there much discussion about markets, or whether it be domestic or international markets?
They were talking about some of the markets that they'd identified over in Germany, like straw for the biomass of heating, I guess, burning these straw pellets for heating. They compared the energy density and the how well they burn with wood and wood chips. Straw is obviously, they use it a fair bit over there in Europe, but I don't know, for something of that price to be pelletizing straw, I'm not whether it's a high enough value product to warrant using a machine like that to pellet straw. But look at this, I guess they've developed the machine and it's up to, I guess, the agricultural community to find out what it can do, what products they can use it on, and I guess to develop the markets from there. They've just put this machine out to the agricultural industry and the markets to develop from there.
Now, you're a hay producer yourself. Could you ever see this machine having a fit in your business?
I'd be open to the idea. I reckon there's definitely market for a pelletised product. Yeah, I'd be open to it. So who knows? I mean, call me back in 15 years and we might have one of them on the farm. We'll see what happens.
That was Corbin Schuster, a farmer at Freeling in South Australia, speaking to Angus Furley. Now let's head to the markets. And first today to Bairnsdale with Brendan Fletcher.
G'day Pete, numbers decreased to 230, that's 65 fewer, with most of the usual buyers operating in a mixed market. Quality was limited, with cows representing over half of the sale. Feelers were in short supply, while a few pens of yearling heifers improved around 30 cents. Quality was an issue in the grown steers and bullocks. Cows sold firm to 10 cents easier, with processors loading cows for an estimated 450 to 528 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls lost 10 cents. Veelers sold from 275 to 340. Heifers to the trade 295 to 318. Grown steers and bullocks 286 to 310. Most light and medium weight cows 185 to 243. Heavyweights 223 to 272. Heavy bulls 245 to 291. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. And now to Colac with Eric Gastrain.
It was like comparing chalk and cheese, as the quality this week at Colac was well down and there was less competition present, combined with lower prices as well. The reduced size yarding of 228 head, 107 less, saw young cattle sell 20 cents cheaper, with odd restocking sales only slightly easier. Grown steers made a little less and grown heifers were back by 15 cents, while most cows sold 10 to 15 cents lower. The odd B3 veeler made 330 cents. Other sea-muscled young cattle were between 260 and 306 cents, while D2 steers made 256 to 262. C3 and C4 grown heifers sold between 250 and 270 cents a kilogram. Heavyweight C3 and C4 beef bred cows made from 240 to 277 cents, with D2 cows between 220 and 251. The D1 cows were from 207 to 223, with E1 grades at 128 and 190 cents a kilogram. The two B2 heavyweight bulls sold for 280 and 290 cents. It's been Eric Gastrain reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Eric. Let's hear from Leanne Dax at Wagga.
Good afternoon. 37,000 lambs here today and 10,000 sheep. The market for trade lambs was back $10 to $15, averaging around 924 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy lambs were well supplied, but there wasn't the weight in the yarding. They were firm to 2 cents easier, averaging 930 cents a kilogram carcass weight and topping at $330. Store lambs were back 10 to 15. The tops of those made to 177. The highlight of the sale today is the sheep market. We're up to $296 for crossbred ewes, weighing around 45 kilos, but there's a lot of sheep hitting $200. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. And last to Chris Agnew at Hamilton.
Agents yarded 14,453 sheep at Hamilton, where the overall quality was starting to lighten off, with not as many heavy and extra heavy crossbred ewes on offer. However, there were some very good lines of well-finished merino web on offer this week. All the regular buyers were in attendance, but not all operated fully in a market that was firm to slightly gearing for the heavyweight sheep and softer for the medium weights, being $5 to $8 per head cheaper. Merino mutton to average around $7.30 to $7.50, and the heavyweight sheep 7 to 7.10. Light one and two score ewes 65 to 130. Mediums 140 to 230. Heavyweights 190 to 275. Lightweight one and two score wethers 88 to 135. Medium weight 3 and 4 score wethers 145 to 200, and the heavies made from 190 to 287. Hoggets made from 123 to 245. Merino rams 130 to 185, and all the other breeds $40 to $70 per head. At Hamilton, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Chris. And that's all we've got time for on the Country Hour today. It's been great having your company here at the Australian Dairy Conference. Warwick Long has just put some grilled cheese pizza in my hand. So we're off to have some lunch. Hope you have some too. Talk to you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.